Charlie, he said, pouring the inspector another drink without asking, I want a word with you. Scott made his excuses and Steve escorted him to the front door, leaving the two men alone. Before Paul could say anything, Charlie took a folded-up evening paper from his raincoat and tossed it across to him. There was a photograph of a very photogenic Jenny Mortimer kneeing Leo Ashwood in the groin. The accompanying story described how Jenny had had a date to meet Kelby at 10 o'clock to discuss her father's debt. Paul looked up in horror. You realize this is going to get her killed. Why? Asked Vosper. Because it implies that she was in the immediate vicinity of the murder. She might even have witnessed it, or seen the murderer pass by on his way to dump the body on Mortimer's farm. Yes, but don't interrupt me while I'm thinking aloud. Don't you know why Gladys Ashwood was killed tonight? She was killed because our murderer is on the run. She was onto him, and now he'll think Jenny is onto him. He's desperate, Charlie. He'll kill again with no compunction whatsoever. Vosper was bewildered. Do you think Jenny Mortimer saw it happen? It doesn't matter what I think. The point is that in order to cover his tracks, the murderer will have to get rid of her just in case. Blast that photographer. He stood up. Look here, Temple, do you know who this killer is? Of course I do. So what's the next move? Vosper was a worried man. We must look after Jenny Mortimer. If we can keep her safe for the next 24 hours, I reckon we can crack this case. At the moment, we could never prove a thing. Paul smiled reassuringly at the policeman. Don't worry, I'll give you proof, Charlie. I promise you, I'll give you the proof. I just need help from two people. As Charlie Vosper prepared to leave, there was a ring at the doorbell downstairs. I'll let them in, Charlie said as he shook hands with Steve. Good night. Paul watched him out from the landing. He watched Charlie Vosper open the front door and heard him say, What the hell? Jenny Mortimer was standing on the step with an evening paper in one hand and a weekend case in the other. My dear Mrs. Temple, I've been set up as the next murder victim. Did you expect me to sit pathetically at home and wait for the knife in my back? Look at this newspaper report. Don't you have a big, strong boyfriend you could stay with? Steve asked icily. Jenny shrugged. Only your good-looking husband had the courtesy to talk to me at the funeral, and I couldn't stay in the village. So here I am. Paul picked up the suitcase and carried it upstairs. You're very welcome to stay, isn't she, darling?
Of course, darling.
Let me show you to the guest room. He led her upstairs to the room opposite their bedroom. A murderer would have to climb 50 feet of sheer wall to reach the window, or come up through the inside of the house. Paul watched her bounce on the bed and wondered whether she was truly afraid of death. She grinned at him. It was difficult to imagine Jenny dead. Her body was so full of life and pleasure. I'll leave you to settle in, Paul said as he deposited the case on the bed. Downstairs, Steve was cleaning up with grim ostentation. She clattered about in the kitchen and then spoke to Paul about the girl's comfort with brittle formality. I didn't know she'd turn up here, he said lamely.
I'm not complaining.
Paul poured himself a whiskey. It's all right, I'll soon have this case cleared up.
Good. The poor girl is scared. So I see.
It was a difficult evening. Steve became heavily ironic about the big manly protector, and then Jenny came downstairs to suggest they throw a party. It would take all our minds off this awful business. No party. But the girl spent the next 40 minutes on a series of telephone calls to advise her friends that she was alive and well and living with Paul Temple. Eventually, Steve went upstairs to wash her hair, and Jenny, relaxing, draped herself along the sofa.
Your wife's a bit peeved, isn't she?
Paul turned round and nodded. Slightly.
Are you in love with her?
Of course.
She looks pretty tough. I don't suppose you stood a chance when she decided to marry you. Shall we stay up talking all night? I can tell you the story of my life. You can use it in your next novel. Shall I tell you how I seduced Leo Ashwood? I did it for a dare. I could tell from the way he was always staring at me that he was twisted up with frustration. He used to stand behind me when I was playing.
Tell me about Alfred Kelby.
I didn't seduce Alfred. He was a sort of father to me. I think he was trying to make up for what Leo had done, poor thing.
She laughed with her mouth open.
Alfred was really an English gentleman. He accepted responsibility for the actions of his servants. We didn't sleep together till I was 19. Tracy Leonard was his mistress.
Not for several years past, said Paul.
She giggled complacently. Do you think she's better looking than me?
Yes.
It wasn't until after midnight, and the best part of a bottle of whiskey, that Paul managed to persuade Jenny to turn in, then went to his own room. Steve lay on her side, pretending to sleep. She'd hit the hay a long time previously. Paul prodded her and tried to say friendly things about how tiresome young girls can be.
If she's still here tomorrow, Steve suddenly piped up, fully awake, I'll murder her myself.
Tracy Leonard went into the church by herself. A single bell was tolling, calling the faithful of Milford Cross to worship. About 50 people were trailing across the green. Paul Temple climbed out of his Jaguar and joined the congregation. He took a hymn book from the verger as he entered the church, murmuring, "Good morning," and sat in the pew opposite Tracy Leonard. The organist was doodling a tuneless variation on a theme by Bach.
"Is this a pleasant coincidence?" Tracy Leonard whispered when she realized who was sitting next to her.
"Very pleasant," Paul whispered.
Her scent contrasted nicely with the dust and leather smell of the church. She looked serenely poised in her grey two-piece. Paul wondered again why Alfred Kelby had let her go in favour of Jenny Mortimer. Paul had found himself immensely relieved as he left home. He hadn't realised what a strain the girl's presence had put on them all. She was enjoying her role at the centre of a murder case. Tracy Leonard was more classically English.
"Why have you come here?" she asked.
"I wanted to see you. Perhaps we could have a talk when the service is finished, on our way up to the house."
She agreed.
"But I have an awful lot to do. The police are still disrupting us with their questions. I'd like to be back as soon as possible."
The choir and vicar were moving up the aisle. The service was beginning. Paul relaxed for an hour to enjoy religion in the simple community. He appreciated Christianity with fields and animals and the wind whistling outside the church, where the changing seasons affected one's life and men worked to produce a visible necessity for their own lives. And the congregation made a joyfully restrained English noise. The choir was better if you closed your eyes. They sounded enthusiastic, unsubtle, and happy. They looked like the local schoolmaster, a garage mechanic, a few farm labourers, and a reluctant rabble of schoolboys. Paul was oddly moved by the soloist, a fleshy man of 50 with an unhealthy face and a beautiful tenor voice. His voice soared to the beams of the church when he sang, clutching his stomach and looking absurdly pleased with himself. He was the kind of man who came into his own each Sunday when his friends stopped laughing and the village listened to him in awe. It was sad, Paul thought, that the vicar didn't realise the importance of his rural authenticity. He tried to relate God and his congregation to the big wide world, and so the mood was dispelled. He preached a sermon on the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," with examples from that morning's newspaper coverage of the Kelby story. The vicar was uncompromisingly against murder. Paul wondered, as the service ended and the flock moved slowly out into the midday drizzle, how many people the vicar thought he had saved from the gallows and eternal damnation. "Why on earth did you come here?" Tracy asked. "We could perfectly well have talked at the house. I wanted to see you away from the others."
"The others?" she repeated in surprise.
"Mr. Ashwood, Ronnie Kelby, the police, anyone who might be around."
She seemed about to say something, but she changed her mind and led the way to the gate. Paul fell into step beside her. She refused his offer of a lift in the dry Jaguar. She always walked to church and back every Sunday. Hers was an ordered life. "What happened last night, Mr. Temple?" she asked after a moment. "Why was Gladys murdered?"
"Because she knew who killed Alfred Kelby."
Tracy walked on in silence. There were flowers in the hedgerow already, but Paul didn't know what they were. Small white flowers, probably weeds, and the fields looked very green in the slight rain. He resented the way London prevented him from knowing the time of the year. It was nearly 3 months since they'd stayed in their country cottage.
He and Steve had spent Christmas there.
Who did kill him, Mr. Temple? She asked tensely.
The same person who killed Gladys, he said noncommittally. Miss Leonard, after we found Kelby's body, I talked to Leo Ashwood and his wife in the kitchen.
I know, she said impatiently. I was there.
You weren't in the kitchen. Mrs. Ashwood said she had to go into the village because she'd forgotten something.
That's right. A suit of Mr. Kelby's. She sent it to the cleaners. People worry about irrational things in moments of crisis.
Did she return to the village?
Yes, said Tracy. She glanced at him sardonically. Mr. Reed gave her a lift. She clearly regarded the subject as irrelevant, but she tried to be helpful. Mr. Reed called round just as you left. He'd heard about the murder, and of course he was very upset. He embarrassed everyone by apologizing about the diary and explaining that he had never imagined it would lead to this. I just had to get rid of him.
Paul grinned. It was a scene he could imagine only too clearly.
So I asked him to give Gladys a lift into the village. That got rid of both of them.
How did Gladys get back?
Her husband picked her up later.
She faltered in her stride and turned to Paul.
Incidentally, Mr. Reed telephoned me yesterday afternoon. He wants to talk to me about Mr. Kelby's will. Apparently he and I are executors.
You sound a little surprised, said Paul. Didn't you know Mr. Kelby had appointed you as executor?
No, I didn't.
She continued up the hill again. Well, I suppose I did. He said something about it ages ago, but he was always changing his mind about wills and that sort of thing.
He probably imagined that every change in his will gave him a new lease of life. He was very superstitious. He didn't like to think that his death had been settled.
When they reached the top of the hill, Paul looked back at the village. It was a village like most others, but the design had never been improved on.
He liked it. Look, Mr. Temple, I don't want to be rude, but you still haven't told me what you want.
Eh? No, that's true, I haven't. Paul smiled and turned away from the view. Last night I stuck my neck out and told Inspector Vosper I could solve this case. I told him I could solve it within 24 hours, provided two people were willing to help me. I was referring to you, Miss Leonard, and a man called Arthur Grover.
I've never heard of Arthur Grover.
Paul laughed. I don't expect you have.
And I can't imagine I would be able to help you.
I want you to go to the cinema, he said enigmatically, ignoring her look of astonishment.
I could go to the one in Oxford, she ventured. That's usually got something worth seeing on.
Good idea. Go tonight. He kissed her on the cheek and left her wondering which of them was mad. Paul returned to London and decided to take Steve out on the town. She sat in the passenger seat of the Jaguar and watched the lights of Soho flash gaudily by.
So how was your day?
She inquired. Pretty good. Got back from Melford Cross about 2 and went out for lunch with Scott.
Did you discuss your new novel?
No, Kelby. They parked in a street behind the casino club and walked back.
Why this place in particular? Steve asked.
It's owned by Arthur Grover and Neville Delamore. She stopped in the entrance and turned to Paul.
You mean we're here on business? I thought we were having an evening out. Just you dare spoil it, Paul, that's all.
A man in an admiral's uniform saluted them as they walked in. The foyer was crowded with rich people who had money to lose on the top floor. Paul took Steve's arm and guided her gently through to the cocktail bar. Good evening, he said to the bartender. My name is Paul Temple. Mr. Grover is expecting me.
Yes, of course, sir, he said with a smile. I'll let Mr. Grover know you're here.
Paul said, you remember what Arthur Grover told me about his telephone call to Ronnie Kelby on the day the old boy disappeared?
Yes, Steve replied, that his father could be found in the garden shed.
Well, he's making another phone call tonight.
Another call? Steve looked at him for a moment. Why?
Because I've asked him to. Before Paul could explain, Arthur Grover had arrived, waving his cigar and calling good evenings in all directions. Good evening, Mrs. Temple. What would you like to drink? He flicked his fingers at the bartender. Frank here mixes the best martinis in London.
Steve nodded approvingly. I gather you're helping my husband.
Yeah, isn't that generous of me? To stay in business, an American club owner has to help all kinds of people, but I keep a list of them.
He laughed good-naturedly. If I ever see your husband down on the floor, I'll kick his head in. Paul laughed. The previous telephone call had been made on Monday at 8:45, so they stayed in the bar exchanging pleasantries. Then, at 8:45, they went through into Grover's office. Of course, last Monday I used the public call box, he said as he picked up the phone and dialed. Paul heard the voice on the other end of the line as Grover said, Good evening. I've spoken to you once before, Mr. Kelby, on the night your father disappeared. The night you killed him and took the body to Galloway Farm. He nodded to Paul, confirming that he was speaking to the same man as before. I'm Arthur Grover, and you know perfectly well what I'm talking about. Your father was alive when we left him in the garden shed, and he was alive when you found him. There was a long pause. Paul wondered whether the person on the other end of the line had hung up. Suddenly, Grover winked. Yes, Mr. Kelby, of course I can prove it. I have a photograph of you carrying the body out of the shed. The man on the other end began talking quickly and excitedly. Grover gave Paul the thumbs-up sign. The trick had worked. Come along, Steve. Let's go and enjoy that meal. They left the office and went downstairs to the dining room. That was hardly a conclusive phone call, Steve said. What's going to happen now? Grover is arranging to meet the man who killed Alfred Kelby, to hand over the photographs. Steve smiled knowingly. But instead of Grover, you'll keep the appointment. That's right, Steve. Tomorrow morning at Marlowe, 11:00. Steve sat nervously at the table and glanced at the menu. From now on, this evening out belongs to me. It was 1:00 when they got back home, but there was a surprising number of people about. There were two police cars in the mews and an ambulance arrived as Paul was getting out of the car. The others seemed to be passers-by with nothing better to do at night than watch a girl lying dead on the pavement. Oh, God, Paul muttered. He's got Jenny. She was wearing the clothes she'd worn the previous night, and in the light from the street lamps her body could be seen twisted and smashed. A huge puddle of blood was black in the light. She looked, Paul thought bitterly, like a broken child's doll. Kate Balfour was talking to the police, telling them that she'd been with the girl all evening until at midnight she had popped home to fetch her sleeping things. I was only gone 15 minutes. Paul knelt beside the girl and touched her cold face. She'd fallen the 50 feet from the guest room window. He glanced up. It was meant to look like suicide. Paul Temple leaned over the parapet and looked down into the murky water. It was a fine morning, and the sun was shining across the Thames. Paul gestured to the police launch below. A uniformed officer and two plainclothes men were ready. Paul glanced at his watch. 10 minutes to 11. Paul wondered uneasily which direction the killer would come from. It would be unthinkable, he thought ironically, to be killed without ever knowing it. He walked to the south end of the bridge and stared down the road from Henley. Of course, the killer might have been waiting the past 2 hours in the hotel by the river. That would be the wisest place to ensure that no ambush was set up. Paul strolled back to the north side. A police car was parked in the private entrance to a boatyard a few yards downstream. Then the clock struck 11. He'd never established whether Gladys had been stabbed in the back or whether the knife had been thrown by an expert at 20 yards. Paul braced his shoulders and turned round. The protection seemed an awful long way away. He felt rather conspicuous, alone on the bridge. A Rover was coming along the road from Henley. When it reached the hotel, it turned off into the car park. Paul waited, and a few moments later Scott Reed emerged from it. He scurried towards the bridge like a nervous crab. The police had not moved. Suddenly he saw Paul on the bridge. His hand twitched involuntarily in the beginnings of a wave. Then he stopped. He glanced forwards and backwards before hurrying down the steps to the towpath. Scott! Paul shouted. Paul ran to the stairs and called down to the publisher. Scott, what the hell are you doing here? Scott came up the stairs as the four policemen converged on him from the nearby boathouse and the hotel. He smiled ingratiatingly. Oh, hello, Paul. I just came to see... You damned fool, Paul snapped. Don't you realise you've upset the whole operation? Temple, look out, someone shouted. Paul swung round in time to see a man racing towards him from the opposite side of the bridge. Two more policemen were pursuing Leo Ashwood in Paul's direction. Leo stopped and drew a gun from his pocket. He fired a couple of shots, one at Paul, the other at the police behind him. When Paul peered cautiously around the side of the stone stairs, a policeman was lying in a pool of blood, and Leo Ashwood was standing on the parapet. Nothing seemed to be happening. Leo, Paul called. Don't be silly. You're making things worse. I'll shoot. Leave me alone. You can't escape, so let's be sensible. I'll come and collect the gun from you, and then the police will look after you, he paused. All right, I'm coming out. Paul stepped onto the bridge. He walked slowly along the pavement towards the centre. He felt extraordinarily relaxed, interested to find himself behaving like this, and coldly rational about the chance that Leo might shoot. He felt slightly sorry for Leo. The man was terrified and trapped. I'll shoot, Leo shouted. Don't think I won't kill you. You tricked me with that telephone call. Keep away, you bastard, you tricked me. Paul continued his walk towards him. He thought disinterestedly that Leo was talking in clichés. People under stress always fall back on clichés. Paul decided that if he lived to write his serious study of murder, he would have to remember that. No elegant dialogue during the death throes. Whilst he was thinking this, he was simultaneously aware of a car moving behind him. The fools, he thought to himself. They'll ruin everything. I'll shoot, Leo shouted, a pleading tone adding to his desperation. Don't think I won't. I'll shoot. The police car had roared onto the bridge and it screeched to a halt beside the shot policeman. Its four doors flew open and three uniformed officers sprang into the open. The fourth door had been opened by Charlie Vosper, but he didn't offer himself as a target. He waited until Leo had fired two more shots before emerging. Leo was as surprised at the explosion of the gun as the policeman whose arm was splintered by the bullet. He staggered sideways and lost his balance. Paul ran forward to grab his legs, but Leo was waving his arms about as he toppled from the bridge, while Paul tried to hang on to his ankle. Charlie Vosper grabbed the other leg, but Leo was too heavy. He fell with a scream into the river below. You're a bloody hero, aren't you? Vosper snarled. It would have worked, Paul said calmly. Leo was swimming against the current now, swimming towards the bank as the police launch roared into action. It swung out into the centre of the river and headed for the same spot on the bank. But Leo was clearly not a strong swimmer and his clothes were hindering him. He disappeared under the water once, then reappeared splashing and spluttering. The police launch changed course and made straight for him, but it was too late. Leo went under for a second time and failed to re-emerge. Steve, it's me, Paul shouted cheerfully. Hi, she waved over the balcony, then came down the staircase. You sound as if it went well. It didn't go too well. It's always bad when a man is dragged off by the currents and drowned, and a couple of policemen suffered minor injuries. The best we can say is that events have reached their conclusion. The pattern has been completed. He kissed her lightly on the top of the head. I'm always glad when a case is over, he admitted. I'll be able to do some writing now. Nothing but boredom for the next few weeks, I'm pleased to say. He sat down. Speaking of boredom, Scott Reed's invited us down to Hambledon for dinner tonight. Oh, no, said Steve. Do we have to? No, of course not. I told him we'd go out to that pub in Hindhead for supper. The restaurant behind the pub overlooked the Devil's Punch Bowl, a massive dip in the Sussex Downs, lined with trees and bracken on every side. Paul felt they were dining on the edge of the world. You're not very good company, darling, Steve intruded into his thoughts. No, I'm sorry, I was thinking about the Kelby affair. He began talking about the case and explained the trap they'd set for Leo. I had to tell Scott what I was doing, he explained, because I needed the information about Kelby's will. And the stubborn devil refused to give it to me unless I took him into my confidence. Scott was smiling and sitting there with his slimly dignified wife, as if the world began and ended with the first editions of significant modern novels. Kelby was about to make a new will in favour of his son. I suppose Leo Ashwood knew that, said Steve. Precisely. He also knew that the current will was very much in his favour. Until Ronnie came home like a prodigal son, Leo stood to inherit nearly everything. So he must have been pretty furious, just waiting, in fact, for an opportunity such as Arthur Grover gave him.
He could, Mrs. Reed suggested bloodthirstily, have simply bumped off Kelby in the night, any night.
Perhaps he meant to, but when Grover telephoned during that evening, it was a marvellous opportunity. Ronnie was out with Tracy Leonard, remember? They were searching for Kelby. So the moment Grover said he had information...
Leo, Steve interrupted, pretended he was Ronnie Kelby.
Right. He realised that his murder was ready and waiting to be committed. All Leo had to do was to go into the gardener's shed and strangle Alfred Kelby. Then he took the body across to Galloway Farm in order to throw suspicion on Ted Mortimer.
Yes, Paul continued.
Ted Mortimer was a well-known enemy of nearly everybody in Melford Cross. Still is, I suppose, poor devil. They continued eating in silence. Paul was wondering whether he could have saved the life of Jenny Mortimer.
I suppose, Steve said, that as soon as Arthur Grover rang up Melford House and said that he had some photographs of Leo disposing of the body, he knew who had taken the photographs. Jenny Mortimer's life wasn't worth living.
You think so? Paul asked. He filled his glass with more wine. But, anyway... He knew there were no photos. He wished the tone of the conversation weren't so resolutely cheerful in its speculation. He wished they didn't expect him to be good company. They were casting accusing glances in his direction.
And what about that shoe I was left with? Scott Reed asked insensitively. Did Leo used to inherit Kelby's old clothes?
Well done, Scott. Paul genuinely laughed at the man's enthusiasm to know all the trivial details. And poor Gladys. She came to see me because she knew her husband was the killer.
She must have guessed, Steve agreed, convinced of the power of feminine intuition. But how did you manage to get Ronnie out of the house so that Leo would take Grover's second phone call?
That wasn't easy. But I caught Tracy Leonard in a Christian frame of mind, and I persuaded her to take Ronnie to the cinema. She hates the sight of Ronnie, and he's been making passes at her for weeks. I hope they won't blame me if they eventually marry and live unhappily ever after. Paul ordered another bottle of wine. It was a pleasantly euphoric evening, and after an hour or so the world became less real, and guilt lost its edge of pain. Paul began telling them about the sailor who was hanged beside the pub so many years ago. It was a gothic, mythic world beyond the window, a world of good and evil, a country scene where devils drank punch, and the night was filled with electrical storms.
"Send for the landlord," said Paul. "He'll know about the local folklore. Ask him to join us for a brandy."
Steve welcomed him with a smile.
"My husband is researching a book on gratuitous death," she explained.
It turned out that the landlord had a morbid frame of mind, too.
"Local legend has it was a ritual murder. Some secret cult being practiced down there in the clearing."
He was a bluff military type, and the folklore would not disturb his sleep.
"Why was it never solved?" Paul asked him.
"Police were out of their depth. We had an exactly similar murder here last month, and they aren't making any progress with that."
"Exactly similar?"
Paul and the landlord became lost in conversation. Steve recognised only too clearly the eager interest her husband was showing. So much for the life of boredom they'd been looking forward to. She wished they'd stayed at home that evening.
Temple and the Kelby Affair by Francis Durbridge was read by Anthony Head and is published by BBC Audiobooks.